Welcome to the Asia Chessboard, the podcast that examines geopolitical dynamics in Asia and takes an inside look at the making of grand strategy. I'm Andrew Schwartz at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This week, Mike and Jude are joined by Dimitri Sevastopoulou, U.S.-China correspondent with the Financial Times. They discuss reporting on China, the bilateral relations between Beijing and Washington, and explore Washington's bipartisan consensus on China.
Welcome back to the Asia Chessboard. I'm joined, as always, by my colleague Jude Blanchett at CSIS, and our guest today, Dimitri Sevastopoulou, the U.S.-China correspondent for the Financial Times, looking not only at the U.S.-China strategic competition, but regional dynamics, and bringing to it a career covering Asia geopolitics in Hong Kong and Japan. Dimitri, great to have you. I'm going to ask you a really important question up front, which is, who are all your sources in the administration?
Well, you know, Mike, I don't really want to out you and Jude on the podcast, so I think I'll just leave that one there for now. But we can talk about that some other point.
Darn. All right, we'll go to the next one, which we ask everyone, which is, how'd you get into this business? How does a kid with a Greek name growing up in Ireland end up becoming one of the leading correspondents on the most challenging geopolitical issue of our time?
The short version is I ended up in Japan to try and make some money to go back to Ireland and become a barrister. Took a detour in Tokyo, started studying Japanese, and my two best friends in my Japanese class were from China. So at one point they said, we've gone to your country to study English. It's a tiny little island. Isn't it about time that you went to China and studied this big, huge country? And so I went to China, did a little bit of Chinese, came back to Japan, and I had been a translator in Japan at one point, and then I ended up working for Bloomberg in Tokyo. And that was kind of my first main job in journalism. And then it was all downhill from there.
But you chose to follow the breadcrumbs on geopolitics at a time when, let's face it, that's not what the cool kids did. The cool kids did economics. And what drew you to it?
Well, you know, so I ended up starting kind of properly. So I did a year in Bloomberg where I covered the Japanese economy, went to grad school in the States, and then moved to Washington and kind of got in through the back door at the FT. I wasn't even an intern at the time, to be honest, and ended up covering the Pentagon. And 80% of my job was covering Iraq, Afghanistan, war on terror, Guantanamo. But because I had an interest in Asia and had lived in Asia for a long time, I started doing North Korea and China. And the officials in the administration, you might know some of them, Mike, no one was talking to them. So they were lonely. And so some Irish guy would call up and say, hey, can we meet and have a coffee and talk about Kim Jong-il? And they'd say, sure. What are you doing this afternoon? So I kind of got into it that way. And then even as I changed beats at the FT over the years and moved to Asia and then moved back, even when I was doing other things, I always kept a hand in the kind of the Asia file because I just had a personal interest and I really loved doing it.
Yeah. And of course, I was never one of those officials ever, right?
I'd never heard of you until last week.
Yeah. Good. Just cleared that up. So the China bit is fascinating. I didn't actually know that. And I love it that they told you some countries are big countries and some countries are small islands. And I hope you added with good beer.
I said that, Ireland, we basically, for example, we consider the U.S. to be our colony, but we just don't boast about it. So,
well, as they say, Ireland-PRC relations are incredibly important because together, Ireland and the PRC have the second largest GDP in the world.
They do. I'm glad you pointed that out.
So what's going to be really interesting about this podcast is we're going to look at how serious correspondents cover the issues we talk about on the podcast, which will be really interesting in terms of the angles you bring, but also how you do it and your history. I'm not saying you're old, Dimitri, but your distinguished history covering the region. How has media coverage of Asia changed? Do you find there's more demand? There must be. You've got this post, but how have the issues changed, the access?
I think, the demand has definitely increased. And even in Washington, you had the pivot to Asia that started under the Obama administration. And you've seen more outlets here put more resources into covering China and covering Asia. But what tends to happen is the pivot, as in real life, the pivot in journalism gets undone. And so you'll have a bunch of correspondents digging into China. And then all of a sudden, the Ukraine invasion will happen or the, Gaza, Israel will happen. And so there's kind of like a tug of war. And I think there's kind of a center of gravity in Washington that people are more used to covering Europe and the Middle East or Russia. And so when there's a choice between the two, correspondents who haven't lived in Asia and maybe don't have a background in China or Japan or somewhere else in the region, it can be easy to kind of fall back to the European story, the NATO story. And obviously right now, given that you've got a, you know, big war on the continental, you know, in Europe, people are obviously focused on that and the same in Gaza. But I think increasingly you're seeing publications devote more resources to Asia. And in our case, you know, we have a big team on the ground in countries in Asia and they're fantastic and I work with them all the time. But we deliberately decided to set up this US-China/Indo-Pacific beat in Washington, which we had never had before. And I think that was kind of an important signal to people as well that the FT is taking this really seriously.
Did it increase the boss's appetite for Asia coverage that Nikkei Shimbun purchased the FT and built this partnership and beefed up Nikkei Asia, which I read, which is clearly in a strong place after the merger? Did that kind of, uniquely for FT, increase the Asia focus?
It did in one sense, but we had actually, you know, right now, I mean, very few people read the physical paper. Most of the bulk of our readership is online, like well over 1 million people subscribe online. But when I started, we actually had a dedicated Asian edition that we had set up. And so we were focused a lot on Asia then. Now we just have one international edition and one UK edition for the physical paper. So we were already putting a lot of resources in Asia, but, you know, having Nikkei as an owner and they have been an excellent donor. They've invested in us. And we, you know, we have a division between the two organizations, but they invest. And I think, you know, having them, it reminds people from time to time if they forgot that, you know, Asia exists, it's a good reminder. But, you know, our readers want to know what's happening in the Indo-Pacific, everything to do with security, trade. It's the most dynamic region in the world. And so FT readers want to know what's happening. So it's not easy to sell stories, let's put it that way. Sorry, not hard to sell stories.
As a native Washingtonian, I get it. But why Washington? Why not put the person covering geopolitics in Singapore or Tokyo?
Well, I mean, two reasons. One is we have good correspondents in, you know, many countries in the region. I mean, any FT reader will know that I work very closely with Catherine Hill in Taipei, who is hands down the best reporter in Taiwan. Kana Inagaki, our bureau chief in Tokyo, she's fantastic. So we have a great network. In my case, the truth is it was partly a personal thing. I had been bureau chief during the Trump years. Normally at the FT, you do one election as a bureau chief and then, you know, it's like the Foreign Service, you rotate to something else. I had done two. It was time to move. For personal reasons, we need to stay in DC as a family. And so I actually pitched to the FT and said, why don't we create this new US-China job? And there was no guarantee they would have gone for it. But I think it was the right time. And obviously, I had a background in Asia. So they thought, well, it's not a bad idea. Let's give it a whirl. And, you know, I haven't been fired yet. So,
well, maybe this podcast will do it.
It could do.
I mean, the danger always is people might think, not just having a bureau, but the way a lot of the region thinks about or Europe thinks about geopolitics in Asia. The danger is, you know, people start thinking it's all US-China and it's not. It's much more complicated. But you're a Japan guy and you've been in Hong Kong. And so you get that multipolarity and that broader context. I'm going to get you to grill you a bit on the state of US-China relations. But before I do that, can you tell us, I mean, I know some of your scoops. When I was in government, I avoided getting scooped, I think. What are some of the scoops on Asia that you're proudest of?
I mean, I think the biggest one, and I guess I'm most proud of, is in 2021, I reported that China had sent this hypersonic weapon around the world, that it circumvented the globe. And it shocked a lot of people. I also got a lot of the journalistic equivalent of hate mail, where specialists in missiles and nuclear weapons wrote to me and said, you're an idiot, you don't know what you're talking about. And it was only 2 weeks later when then chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, went public and said it was a near Sputnik moment that, I mean, I knew the story was correct. Obviously, I wouldn't have written it otherwise, but I felt vindicated. But that was a big story. I mean, it got incredible traffic. And I think it showed a lot of people around the world that China had made a lot more progress in terms of innovation than people realize. And they had actually accomplished one thing that the US not only had never done, but the Pentagon scientists at DARPA actually didn't know how China had accomplished one part of the mission that they'd undertaken. I think that shocked people, but it was kind of a wake-up call. And so that was definitely the biggest story. You know, we broke the story that Nancy Pelosi was going to go to Taiwan in 2022. That was a big deal too. So, you know, we're just trying to keep the salary coming in from month to month. And some months we get lucky.
Well, those stories
pretty much vindicate the logic of having a Asia-wide coverage in Washington because it's a target-rich environment.
It is.
Yeah, Dimitri, it's a good segue to the next question I want to ask you, which is your assessment of the state of U.S.-China relations. And I say it's a good segue simply because I think you are often the irritant or the driver of a lot of the policy conversation here. And it's almost always when there's a sort of a story coming on U.S.-China relations, my first thought is it's usually your byline. Such, I think, is the quality of the work you're doing. We're in an interesting position now. We were just talking before we clicked record on some of the real sensitive issues in the U.S.-China relationship. We seem to be in this odd sort of lull. Of course, highly competitive in lots of arenas. It's not as if the relationship has stopped churning. But at a broad level, I'm curious, how would you describe where we are right now? I'm sure you wouldn't call it the San Francisco spirit, but are we in, do you see this as just a sort of temporary detente driven by a convergence of interests in Beijing and Washington? Do you think we're potentially at a new, more stable spot, or do you see a third or fourth possibility?
I guess overall, I think that we're in a kind of a temporary strategic pause. I think both sides, for different reasons last year, well, over the last 2 years, but particularly as we were coming to the San Francisco summit between Xi Jinping and Biden at APEC in November, I think both sides realized that things were getting a little bit out of control. I heard from, U.S. allies and partners in the region in Asia and also in Europe, and from some Americans in Washington, that there was a concern that the language about Taiwan, the combination of the Chinese assertive and aggressive activity, military activity around the island, and some of the things that the U.S. is doing, it was kind of very combustible. And then you had several U.S. generals and admirals making predictions about, military action against Taiwan. And I think there was a feeling that the two countries were heading towards some kind of a conflict, maybe not immediately, but over time. I think that's subsided for now. The San Francisco summit, I think, to my mind, it basically calmed the waters on the surface that for a little while, things are going to be better. A very clear example of that is the last time I checked, which was a few days ago, the U.S. says there has been no what they call risky and coercive intercepts by Chinese fighter jets that, come very close to U.S. spy planes that are flying, off the coast of China, but in international water, in international airspace. So there haven't been any of those for almost 3 months now, which is a positive sign. In San Francisco, the U.S. actually got a few things out of China. China didn't really get a huge amount in return from the U.S. So I think it's stabilized things for now. But to me, the fundamental difficulty in the relationship is, for the foreseeable future, is going to be Taiwan. And I don't think either side has any room to compromise on Taiwan. And so I think that's going to be a flashpoint. We've got the inauguration of the new president coming up at Lai Ching-te in May. And I think there is no solution to Taiwan. The question is, can you continue the status quo you've had for decades, or is something going to blow up either intentionally or accidentally? And I don't see a solution to that. And as long as that's an issue, I don't see how U.S.-China relations will really kind of plow forward into a better place.
And on this, and I know this is obviously for a lot of listeners, concern about Taiwan is rising in importance given the potential effect it could have on really the global economy. What's your assessment on looking to May? Do you see this as the inauguration as a sort of a calendar moment where things could escalate a bit? Do you have any sense on your read on where the Lai administration, then a Lai administration, what they might say at that and how Beijing would respond?
Well, I think over the next 3 months, I guess, it seems to me that the Chinese military reaction to his election in January, and let's point out to the listeners that China considers him to be a dangerous separatist. They do not like Lai Ching-te. But I think that their response to the election was relatively mild by recent standards. My sense is that they're not going to do anything hugely escalatory until his inauguration. I think the first big test is going to be, what does he say in his inauguration speech? He has been, I have not met him personally, but he has been telling a lot of people for, well over 6 months that he's going to essentially adopt the policies and the approach of the incumbent at Tsai Ing-wen, who I think most people would say has handled the situation incredibly deftly. And when there have been crises, she's been very, very skilled and, you know, single-handedly probably prevented some more dangerous things from happening on occasion. He says he's going to follow the same model. People who know him say that it's easy to say that, but he has a very different temperament from her. And I think the big question is, does he have the right kind of temperament to be able to manage crises, which, let's face it, will occur repeatedly over time? And that's a question that can only be answered as we watch how he responds to them and also how he evolves and develops as a leader over time. I mean, who will Lai Ching-te be in 5 years' time? You know, Tsai Ing-wen was a different president, you know, she is now to when she first took office. She's much more capable and people are reassured by the way she handles things. Will Lai follow the same path? We don't know, but that's going to be something everyone's watching incredibly closely, particularly after May when he's in office.
It is striking over the past 8 years that we've come to basically take it for granted that there is a steady hand at the tiller in Taipei. And I, you know, Mike has written a great study of Shinzo Abe. It strikes me that Tsai deserves a book looking at how she, both as a strategist, but also as a leader, has navigated Trump administration, pressure from China, Xi Jinping. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And done so with aplomb and calm and steadiness. And again, as a female leader in a very male-dominated environment, and just done so, I think, to pretty universal acclaim amongst, you know, democracies. And I don't, you know, as you say,
yeah,
we can't say Lai wouldn't continue that tradition, but that's the point. We will have to see. But I think she does not get the kudos she deserves as, I think, a really historic figure in a really difficult time.
Yeah. And if I can just add, I mean, you know, the way she's managed the situation with China is one thing. And I say this as a cheeky Irishman. She's also managed the Americans pretty well. And frankly, that's not always that easy. As you know, one or two of them are a little bit unruly. No names.
I'm going to move quickly on, Dimitri, before you start blurting names out. We think about U.S.-China relations, of course, I think we're automatically thinking about the Biden administration or the White House. But, you know, there are a lot of actors. There are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. One of them is Congress. And what I find, what's so unique about the role that you play or journalists play as analysts, which I think is just provides such an important angle, is you are grounded in these human stories of human actors with agency operating in big, messy systems. So I wanted to ask you a few questions about that. I want to start with Congress, and I want to ask about the role of individual bureaucracies.
Sure.
First question is, as you've been covering the Trump administration, but now the Biden administration, you've talked to a lot of members of Congress, you've talked to a lot of staffers. What is your sense on where sort of Congress is on China? And I'll ask that is, you always hear when you talk to, you know, friends visiting from overseas, this perspective that there's this consensus on China. I think Mike and I have our own answer of how much there consensus there is, but I'm just curious for your own take. How do you usually answer that question?
So I think there's a pretty strong consensus that China is a big challenge for the United States. I think it's easy for people to say there's a consensus on the solution and Democrats and Republicans will always come together. I think you've seen lots of examples where the two parties have struggled and actually within each party, there's also been struggles about what's the solution. I mean, you look at the Republican side, you've got the Select Committee on China in the House that's run by Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher and his Democratic counterpart Rajan Krishnamoorthy, fairly bipartisan. I mean, they do differ sometimes, but they've actually kept a pretty bipartisan approach for the last year as they've been up and running. But, you know, Mike Gallagher has been caught a little bit between the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Mike McCaul, and other senior Republican leadership who haven't wanted him to do some things. So he's been constrained in certain ways. He's also had to work with the Democrats and maybe not go too far in some areas where the Democrats will be uncomfortable. So you see, you know, it's clear if you look closely that it's not completely unified. But I do think overall there is a strong consensus that China is a challenge. And then, you know, not much consensus in what are the best ways to tackle that challenge, which is clearly the most important thing.
Now, in the Republican Party, we're seeing this we're seeing this fairly depressing cleavage take form where we've got a sort of a isolationist wing. And we're seeing this, you know, I think we'll talk about this later. You're seeing this on issues of Ukraine funding. But it feels like the Republican Party is sort of bifurcating, where you've got old traditional Republicans, you know, fairly conventional, sort of aggressive, hawkish approach to foreign policy, want to support Ukraine, want to support Taiwan, want to make investments on China. You're then seeing this new one that I'm not sure we quite know precisely the bounds on it, the sort of J.D. Vances of the world, who I think are looking more to Trump. Can you know, how do you think about, is there sort of a coherent left-right view of China that you see in Congress? Or maybe is it more than just that one spectrum? Is it sort of now four spectrums? I just think about old debates about China or even foreign policy. They had a coherence to them. I don't necessarily, it seems that coherence seems to be fracturing a bit. I'm just curious how you see it.
I think it is fracturing, but in several ways. So I think you have, and in some ways this is going back to the past. I mean, there are historical parallels for some of these things. But I think you're seeing a split between, and I'm an emerging group of isolationalists who think the U.S. should be less involved in the world for different reasons. Sometimes it's because it's not in U.S. interests. Other times it's because the U.S. is spending money to help Ukraine that some people say should be spent on fixing the southern border. But then you have another group of people, which I think is a smaller group, which is the U.S. should be pulling back from supporting Ukraine, doing less in Europe and letting the Europeans pick up the ball there and provide for their own defense. And that the U.S., if it's really serious about China being this phrase that someone told me the other day, the Chinese aren't quite sure how to translate. China is the pacing challenge. Well, if China is the pacing challenge, then you really do need to pivot to Asia in a bigger way. So the question is, do you become more isolationist when it comes to Europe and NATO and shift resources? Can the U.S. afford to do both? And how do you do that? And I think when it comes to China, there are a lot of people who, what their view on China may not necessarily neatly fit their ideological view of the rest of the world. China's kind of almost become a special problem. And I look at it sometimes as not for a moment playing down the things that China is doing in Xinjiang, the repression of the Uyghurs, crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong, very tough national security laws, detaining people in China. There's a whole slew of things that you cannot condone. But I also think that there's a little bit of an element in the U.S. of it's since the Second World War and the U.S. emerged as a superpower. Okay, it had the Soviet Union as a rival for a while, but the Soviet Union was not, you know, manufacturing iPhones and exporting them to Texas. So it wasn't integrated into the global economy the way China is. China is the first country that's a real rival to the U.S. And I think there's a kind of a psychological problem, which is many Americans in Washington psychologically cannot get their head around the fact that this big kid on the other side of the playground is not going away. And so this kind of idea that you sometimes hear the U.S. has to do X, Y, and Z to beat China or to win the race against China. There is no race where there's an endpoint. There's going to be a whole slew of lanes. It'll be like a big racetrack, and you'll have different competitions in different lanes, and at different points in time, the U.S. will be ahead, and at other points in time, China will be ahead. And I think that's the way the world is going to go. But I don't think psychologically a lot of people in Washington see it that way yet. And frankly, I think quite a lot of people in China maybe don't see it that way. So there's a kind of an adjustment going on in both countries as to adjusting to the new reality, which is going to be with us for a very long time, unless something catastrophic happens, which hopefully it won't.
One more question for me, then I'll want to kick it back over to Mike. But I think just picking up on something you were just saying, one of the sort of meta discussions happening now is, what is the power trajectory of China, and has it changed very recently? And I think if we were having this discussion in 2017, around the time that Xi Jinping assumes his second term, I think the dominant view was China's on a near vertical upward trajectory in terms of the growth of its comprehensive power. Problems in the system, sure, but we're seeing a leader consolidate. We're seeing China really flex its muscle globally, Belt and Road Initiative. That's now, I think, post-COVID, you know, and looking at how China catastrophically got out of COVID, I think looking at the economic slowdown, it feels to me like the conversation in Washington has shifted. I wouldn't say it's another round of China's going to collapse soon, but certainly as, you know, my friend Hal Brands and Mike Beckley have written, you know, this idea of peak China. What is your assessment on, I get two-parter. Number one, what is the dominant view in Washington about China's trajectory? And number two, I'm just curious your own view on this. You're a close student of China. Do you agree or disagree with this, the sort of zeitgeist view of China?
I think, you know, so I've been doing this job a little more than 3 years. My first day was Biden's first day as president. So I've been tracking it that whole time. And I think you've seen a shift from this view that China is this kind of 100-meter tall giant that's going to devour the U.S. to more recently, I wouldn't say gleeful, but a view that the Chinese economy is clearly what got big problems right now, the property sector and other areas, overcapacity in its industrial sector. And this is a sign that China has peaked. I think there's a couple of things there. You know, every country goes through difficulties. And while this may signal that China has peaked, one of the things the Chinese government is good at, and I think sometimes people in Washington don't like to admit that the Chinese government is good at some things, but they actually can be quite quick to pivot and tackle a problem when it arises. And, you know, for example, the speed with which it abandoned its zero COVID policy at the end of, I guess, last year, took everyone by surprise. Or when they decide to move, one of the benefits from their perspective of not having a democracy is they can just move. They don't have Congress to say, we're going to mess up your life for a few weeks. So the big question is, will they be able to adjust and restructure their economy and get back on a good pace of growth? You know, some people say that Xi Jinping really doesn't understand economics and that that's one of the problems. And what's been interesting to me in the last couple of months is I'm increasingly hearing from people who describe their conversations in China with Chinese elites that people are criticizing Xi Jinping in private, but they're criticizing Xi Jinping with a much louder volume than they were before. And that's a signal of kind of despair with the way that he's handling the economic situation, the focus that he has put on some national security issues where he has sacrificed economic growth in order to achieve, security gains. So there's a big question mark there. But I do think there's a tendency in Washington for people to kind of, it's like a pendulum, to swing from one extreme to the other. If I'm totally honest, one of the great things about working in Washington as a journalist is there's a phenomenal number of China experts and Asia experts. I mean, it's astounding, and I benefit from their knowledge every day. On the other hand, there's an astounding number of people who know nothing about China and pontificate all day long. And you can't have a real conversation because when you ask them something, they have no facts. But, you know, it's not good in Washington to admit that you have no facts.
Dimitri, why are you pointing at me right now?
I'm pointing in both directions. <yeah. laughs> But I think it's an issue. I think that there's, and one of the probably dangers of the mood right now, which is, you know, people are nervous to go to China for different reasons, often because of what could happen when they get there. But there's a danger that the U.S. invests less in China knowledge, Chinese language skills, and that over time, the U.S. will actually suffer because of that. And I worry about that.
We have made that mistake before, and a lot of historians would say the result was after the McCarthyist period, the depletion of China expertise and Asia expertise and some big mistakes about Vietnam. But that's for another episode. Dimitri, before we close out, I want to ask you as a journalist what you expect to be writing about this coming year that's big and shocking and affects geopolitics. But let's just go to the obvious answer, which is the U.S. presidential election. What are you getting asked about? What are you hearing from the region about what looks almost certain to be a Biden versus Trump race? And what do you anticipate from covering a lot of the people who'd be in that administration either way in Washington?
Well, it's been funny for the last at least 6 months, I would say. Every conversation I have with someone who comes to Washington from overseas, every conversation I've had in capitals around the world, in Tokyo, Singapore, Brussels, and I was in Salzburg, Austria last week. Every conversation, no matter what it starts out being, becomes eventually a conversation about Donald Trump. And, you know, I said to people that I was covering, you know, I was covering politics as bureau chief for I did the whole of the Trump 5.5 years. I thought he would win in 2016, and I said it publicly. I thought Biden would win in 2020. This year,
don't say it.
I don't know.
You'll make it real. You know,
if you ask me to give a presentation tomorrow on why Trump was going to win, I think I could do it convincingly. And if you ask me to do one the following day on why Biden was going to win, I think I could do that one equally convincingly. So clearly that means that I have no idea what's going on. But, you know, countries around the world, if they are not dictatorships or not countries run by someone called Vladimir Putin, they are very, very nervous. I mean, I was saying to you guys before we started the podcast that just in the last few months in Japan, there are three new phrases to describe Trump. The first one is Moshi Tora. And Tora is a shorthand way of saying Trump. Moshi Tora means, you know, if Trump wins. Then it became Hobo Tora, which is like, basically, Trump's going to win. And now it's softened a little bit. It's like a Yaya Tora, which is like, well, maybe he'll win, but it's not so quite sure. You know, the Japanese, I would say, are panicked. Southeast Asians are very nervous. The Koreans also, you know, the Koreans and Japanese are worried that Trump will, if he wins, will talk about pulling U.S. troops out of the region, which he did the first time he was president. In Europe and the NATO countries are scared about Trump putting more pressure on them to step up to the plate and increase their defense spending. And then there's huge, huge concern about whether Trump will actually continue support for Ukraine. And I think that's probably the biggest issue on people's minds right now, because that could have consequences for other things in the world too, including Taiwan. So everyone is very concerned. Everyone is coming to Washington trying to work out who are Trump's advisors, who are they likely to be, what are his policies going to be? And unfortunately, the answer tends to be, it's not clear who the advisors are going to be. There's a few potentially obvious names. But I don't think Donald Trump knows today what he's going to do if he becomes elected. And so you can speculate until the cows come home, and you're not really going to be any wiser. So I think people have to be patient and see what happens.
Yeah, I tell people here in Australia that after Trump got elected in 2016, consumption of alcohol, massages, and therapists' sessions increased about 40% in Washington. I'll predict it increases 70% if he gets reelected. It will not be fun. But, you know, the Japanese, the Australians, the Koreans even got through Trump 1. And the question is, how wild would a Trump 2 be? Probably wilder. But, you know, there are a lot of people who do not have a public profile right now, who are congressional staffers and a lot of members of Congress on the Republican side, who I think would likely go into a Trump administration. So I tell people here and in Tokyo, keep an eye on that space. You're going to have to find your allies. And as we all know, Abe did pretty well. Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison, although Turnbull's not publicly talking about how wild it was, did pretty well for Australia. It'd be tougher to be European. It'd be really tough for Zelensky, but you know, there's a history and there's a structure to American engagement in the world. And the polls show that the public generally is more pro-alliance than they've been in a generation. And you probably saw the poll that Trump's supporters are concentrated around people older than we are, whereas Biden's are people in their 20s and 30s. So there's a question about the future. But it is going to be a real source of uncertainty and discontinuity. There's no getting around it. And we should probably, Jude, do a whole session on that, as painful as it is, about the election. We're trying to do strategy and chessboard, but this is a big, big move by a piece on the board.
Well, Mike, I don't know if you remember this, but years ago, there was a kind of a Japan and North Korea specialist at CSIS who had a quote that he used to put out, which was about Kim Jong-il throwing the chessboard up in the air and the pieces would just fall all over. So maybe this is the time to roll out that quote again.
You know, we started running out of good chess quotes for this podcast about a year ago. That's a good one. We haven't used that, throwing the chessboard in the air. Excellent. Thank you. Your royalties in the mail.
Thank you.
Dimitri, we all read you. Everyone should. I won't ask you what your next scoop is, but I'll be looking every day for it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Good talking to you.
For more on strategy and the Asia program's work, visit the CSIS website at csis.org and click on the Asia program page. And for more on the U.S. Studies Center in Sydney, please visit ussc.edu.au.